Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlo Costain, the editor-in-chief of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the UK policy lead for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
And first of all, I guess, Happy New Year to everybody. And today we're doing things a little bit differently. We've got a special guest, which is Claire Hill from Plant and Farm. She's going to be coming on talking about her new regenerative transition course. And we're going to start, as usual, with a quick roundup of news that's caught our eye on 8.9.com in the last week or so. And later in the programme, we're going to be discussing at a bit longer length the new and improved incentives for nature-friendly farming in England, and also the impact of the loss of cross-compliance post-Brexit. So first of all, let's go straight into, this is a headline, First Milk Farms Revolutionising Biodiversity and Soil Health Assessment. And this is about a new groundbreaking endeavour, they say, with 34 First Milk Farms dotted across Derbyshire being invited to take part in a first-of-its-kind DEFRA-funded research project. And I don't know, Phil, are you aware of the Merlin bird listening app that tells you which birds you're listening to?
I am indeed, Finlo. My wife would use it quite frequently. I don't use it because I previously worked for a conservation organisation and had to learn at quite quick pace what everything was. And it was at the time when these apps didn't really exist. So it was an actual old tape recorder that I used. So I've done it the old school way, but I know that Merlin is pretty effective and, yeah, very, very useful tool out in the field.
It is remarkable, and I've used it with the kids as a way of just, it's sometimes picking out those bird songs that are a bit more distant, that you hear regularly, but you just don't quite know what they are. And what's interesting about this research is that they're trying to achieve the same sort of thing by putting audio probes into soil. So in the same way that the Merlin app has developed this ability to be able to listen to different birds and differentiate them based on the song, they're trying to do the same thing. At the moment, I think it's largely based around worms, but I'm hoping it's going to be around, you know, all invertebrates.
Yeah, and this is where my mind starts to fail to comprehend how this will work, because with Merlin, we have, yeah, probably about 200 species of bird that you would regularly find in the UK. So there's a pretty finite type of database that you have to kind of go through. Whenever you look at the soil and the level of life that's within that and trying to separate it through audio, that makes the mind boggle. So
it does a little.
Yeah.
And clearly they're going to be selective. And I think they are starting off with worms. That's certainly the impression that I get. And they were talking in terms of being able to save farmers, you know, potentially hours from doing lots of different soil surveys around their farm by just putting in these audio probes and being able to count the worms that way, which would be a good time saver. But of course, that's not the only reason farmers dig holes and look at their soil.
Exactly. There's that connection with it and being able to observe, and also looking at not just the biological health, but the physical health, all those sorts of things too, and that kind of connection. But I think the use of technology in this space, I think we've been critical in the past of technological solutions that kind of distract from an agroecological transition. I see this type of stuff as very much being an enabler and, yeah, supporting that kind of journey to different types of farm practice. It's positive to see, and it's, yeah, the opportunities are pretty much endless with this stuff as well. So it's quite exciting.
So moving on to the second of our quick stories, we've got changes to Woodland Carbon Code threaten UK timber supplies. Now, there were changes to the Woodland Carbon Code in 2022. And what we've got here is commentary coming out of the Confer Policy Conference, which took place in December, looking at the way that those changes in 2022 would affect plantations on the ground. And that if you were having a plantation today, then it may well be able to produce only about 50% of the timber that it could have done before those changes in the carbon code took place, you know, a couple of years ago. And one of the things that struck me was not only the fact that we were talking about plantations growing less wood, which obviously is important, but also a quote that came out later on in that particular article from somebody who was the director of the English Woodlands Forestry. I won't name and shame her, but she talks about the distracting irrelevance of the conifer versus broadleaf planting conversation. And it may well be irrelevant within the woodland sector. It may well be something that they wish they could get away from. But it's only irrelevant within the woodland sector. It's clearly something that's very important to an awful lot of people. And I think that this comes back to the conversation around the woodland sector, the timber sector, really needing to understand that they have to make the case for the amount of forestry, the amount of timber that we need to grow in the UK with the general public so that we get some public support and public buy-in for widespread new forestry planting.
Completely agree. That previous comment, I don't think is particularly helpful, because as you say, there are quite a large number of people who, yeah, quite rightly, I suppose, are concerned about, yeah, large scale kind of monoculture conifer plantations. And I understand that this rule has been brought in to try and address that somewhat and try and make these projects maybe a little bit softer for biodiversity, for example, or even for public access as well, because the forest estate is quite important in terms of enabling people to access nature, access, I suppose, a healthy environment. So I think there is a bit of work really to improve the image of this, and also to try and understand some of the complexities as well. So yeah, that is a concern if we are seeing potential timber production. We're in a move towards net zero. We need to see renewable kind of or less carbon intensive building materials, all sorts of things like that, which is a legitimate argument. But then we've also got to weigh up forestry with all these other objectives we want to meet from our land. So it's not simple. And yeah, there's an element of concern in that. But I think the old adage of right tree, right place, but also right purpose as well, is quite important within all of this. So if it's for timber production and the purpose is timber production, then it's sited in the right place to actually deliver what we want from that.
As you say, I think the context is really important. And often when we're talking about monocultures, you know, we're talking about solely Sitka spruce. But often when we're looking at a plantation which has a bit more diversity, it's still different conifer species that are growing within there, if it is a plantation that's largely being grown for timber or for pulping. And there is a degree to which the timber industry is a long way behind where the farming industry conversation is, or even where the renewables sector conversation is. You know, people were very concerned 20 years ago. I mean, there's still a lot of concern today when solar farms are put in or wind farms are put in. And there's been an awful lot of experience built up within the renewables sector about how to talk to communities, how to engage with people whose landscape is going to be impacted. And when we're talking about the fact currently today of importing 70 to 80% of the timber that we use in the UK, and this is based on what we're using timber for right now, when in the future we need to be using an awful lot more timber as building materials. So it's not just about filling the current gap in UK timber security, UK timber supply, but actually rising to meet the potential gap that exists in the future. That's an awful lot of timber. That's an awful lot of landscape change. And if we're talking about having plantations that are growing less in terms of conifers than they were before 2022, that's going to take up even more space. So we really do need to find ways of, A, integrating food and fibre production with the rest of forestry, with biodiversity. At the same time, we genuinely need to have that conversation intelligently, listening to people, engaging with people, so that they can understand why that really substantial landscape change is going to be necessary.
Yeah, and the other element within this as well, because there's a lot of parallels around food production, say, for example, in terms of self-sufficiency arguments. And yeah, you could potentially see both of these objectives in terms of the timber, in terms of the food, coming up against each other if there's this big drive for increased self-sufficiency. And the other argument within this, which I don't see coming up within timber imports as much as it does in relation to food, but is that idea of we are probably going to need to import timber for various different purposes. We're going to need to continue to do so. I'm probably at significant levels. So it's making sure that those imports are of high standard, are of well-managed kind of forestry estates in other parts of the world, aren't contributing towards biodiversity loss, ecosystem decline, carbon emissions, carbon losses from the soil, or even displacement of communities and things like that as well. So it's ensuring that we have as much of a kind of increase that's sustainable at home, and we're also, yeah, not causing negative impacts abroad as well.
It's very hard to envisage the future, but if we're envisaging a future where all nations need to become more independent, not just in terms of food, but in terms of timber supply as well, then actually it may become increasingly difficult to trade these things around the world. And certainly, you know, if that trade is continuing, there's going to be increased competition for it. So we really do need to get a handle on this issue. And this is just, I guess, brings us on to the next short story, which is around woodland regeneration increasing by 25% at a Highlands National Nature Reserve. This is about the natural regeneration of trees, and that this has increased by around 25% in 6 years at Inverashi and Inshriach, I hope I got that right, National Nature Reserve. And this story is important because this natural regeneration has been happening with no planting, no additional planting, and with no deer fences, in which case, which means that, you know, wildlife is able to move freely around these plantations. There's also that public access thing that you were just talking about, so people can move around more easily as well. And yet they're still getting that 25% boost in regrowth. And it's down to, you know, I have to say, deer management. And so that deer management is continuing. This is becoming quite controversial, I think, in Scotland. You know, there is concern from the general public. The Telegraph today, I think, was shouting about the fact that deer culling is part of Nature Scotland's approach to managing the countryside. But clearly that deer management is important in terms of allowing this natural regeneration to take place.
Yeah, essentially in the absence of apex predators that would be managing populations of deer, aka wolves, for example, we're going to have to intervene and control them ourselves. Otherwise, we are going to see overgrazing. We're going to see, yeah, just areas that should, for all intents and purposes, be woody, never getting there. So what choice do we take within this?
Yeah, absolutely. Like it or lump it, human beings have become the apex predator, and therefore we have a role to play in making sure that nature is able to regenerate itself in the way that's essential. Look, we're going to come on to the last story here of this sort of short roundup, which is why nature-based solutions are essential in the carbon market. And just to remind people, these are all stories that are coming from 8.9.com. So if you want more information, just go to the website, and if they've dropped off the homepage, then you'll see underneath each headline there's a little link that says article. If you just click on that, right click on that and do an article search, you'll get loads of articles that have come up, you know, in the last 2 or 3 weeks or so, and all of the ones that we're talking about here will be there. This was an article that was written by Eero Walstedt, first of all, on LinkedIn, and he very kindly allowed us to reproduce it. He's part of Soil Watch, and the particular thing that caught my eye, I think, in the article was this conversation around permanence. And I think there is an assumption, and certainly when you talk to people in a public arena, there is an agreement that permanence of soil carbon stocks or woodland carbon stocks is essential. It's something we should all go for. But I think behind the scenes, there is more nuance. And I'm, you know, really grateful that Eero has kind of put his head above the parapet a bit on this and said, actually, it's not necessarily permanence that we need. It's durability. It's sustainability of a stock, because there are various different ways of defining permanence, none of which are quite permanent, whether it's from 100 years to 10,000 years. What do you think about that, Phil?
Yeah, I read this and I loved it, and it was a bit mind-blowing, and yeah, it kind of brought us into the philosophical around how you use finance to kind of leverage a more holistic and all-encompassing, yeah, positive type of future. And it made the argument that even in theory, yeah, nothing is wholly permanent. There's the risk of certain carbon stocks being lost over relatively short to medium timelines, or very, very long ones, and that this might mean that they are deprioritized in favor of technological solutions which are permanent in terms of the results that they achieve. So the likes of carbon capture and storage, where that carbon is pumped down into the ground. And it makes the point that this may deliver what you want from a carbon perspective, but there's a whole range of other things that we should be looking at on top of this as well. And again, it makes this case around, like, looking at those systemic kind of drivers and the root causes of a lot of unsustainable land management and trying to tackle those as well. Because if we don't do that, then we're only ever going to be developing schemes and offset schemes that aren't really fit for purpose. And again, this kind of need to adapt as well. So there's one kind of quote and message that kind of comes through really, really clearly for me within this. And it's anchoring sustainability into green development is inherently better than anchoring them in time-limited payments such as carbon credits. Payments should fund the transition, not a new status quo that will collapse as they are eventually withdrawn. And I think this will play into to conversations that we'll have later on in the podcast, but it's a really, really important principle. And I just thought this was, a very, very excellent overview on the situation.
Let's take a break. So we're back and we're with Claire Hill from Plant and Farm. Claire, hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you. And what we're going to do is we're just going to talk through a few things because you've been to the Oxford Real Farming Conference just the same as Phil has. And Phil, you didn't get a chance earlier on in the programme to talk about your takeaways from ORFC. So maybe we can come to that as well and then go into, you know, whether there's anything on 8.9 that you've seen, Claire, in the last week that interests you, and then go into your course, which I think is the main bulk of where we want to be. What your course is all about, roots to regeneration. So let's start off with Oxford Real Farming Conference. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, of course. It's a great transition for the beginning of the year from Christmas sluggishness into like thinking and getting excited for the new year. So it was a great session as always.
And what did you enjoy most? Were there particular takeaways, particular sessions that you enjoyed more than others?
Yeah, so I went to a few kind of things that I wouldn't normally go to this time, sort of challenge my own thinking a little bit. And the one in particular was the session with James Binning from Assemble and Assemble Studios, and all about building materials, which is not something I know anything about or think about from a farm production point of view. And it just blew my mind. And particularly the connection with kind of regenerative agriculture. So they were coming out from that end, and I was like, I just didn't even realise that builders were thinking of that. And like some great examples where in Germany they are re-wetting a lot of old peatlands, and then the rushes that grow from on those re-wetted lands are they're then harvesting. And for the rush element to a house, which I can't remember what that is, you need 1.2 hectares of rushes plus the timber to build the frame, and then that's what you need for the house. And I was just like, wow, actually, you know, how unimpactful is that compared to our current building materials? And also what an opportunity as farmers to rethink that. And that's something I've been more interested in lately, is some people almost see it as if you have to do something other than food production, it's some sort of failure or diversification, or you couldn't make it work in food, so now you have to do something else. But land has multiple uses, including people's own health. So, I was fascinated by that session.
I was going to give a shameless plug to the Nature Friendly Farming Network at Oxford Real, and this conversation around fibre production and different uses and kind of regenerative fibre production. And we facilitated a session which was looking at different producers, but also actors within the supply chain. I didn't know anything about this either, but the kind of car industry, and they're starting to look at it as well in terms of some of their parts. And there's a bit of a question there, I think, which is a bit challenging, is, I suppose it's an industry which is reliant on fossil fuels at the moment, but in a way it can help stimulate regenerative farming, but also kind of reduce its impact as well. So, lots of conversations on that front. I always love Oxford Real because one minute you walk into a room and it's a very in-depth conversation about spirituality and relationship with nature. It's quite... quite out there. And then you have the real kind of nitty gritty, this is how you do stuff on the farm. And it's quite a broad church, I thought, of different people there with different perspectives, which is really, really good to see.
Claire, have you seen any articles on 8.9.com in the last week or so that particularly took your interest?
Yeah, the increase in countryside stewardship payments, which was announced at OFC actually by the minister.
And so we got an email. By the Oxford Farming Conference, not the Oxford Real Farming Conference.
It was, yeah. I think that's the event that the minister visited this time, and the increase in rate. So the one in particular that is really significant is the increase in payment rate per hectare, up by hundreds of pounds per hectare on the maintenance and development of species-rich grassland, because I think, hopefully, that is enough of an incentive now to halt this kind of slightly tragic trend we've seen, where people have been incentivized to plough up permanent pasture in order to put in a herbal lay because the payment rate has been so strong for herbal lays. And we've lost a lot of the goodness that that was in those permanent pastures, and with some adequate rest and different grazing patterns could have achieved the same level of diversity without the ploughing, the paying for seed, the soil loss that came when it rained, etc, etc. So I'm really glad they seem to have listened on that one, and that one's like really like brightened my eyes when I heard that one.
Yeah, the payment rates for the species rich grass and options have gone up to around £650 odd, I think, which is a huge increase compared to what they were before. I think they're around 180 or so, and yeah, it really helps to avoid that perverse consequence, as you mentioned, which probably wasn't really anticipated and would have ended up in biodiversity loss or biodiversity degradation, as opposed to driving towards better ecological outcomes.
Fantastic. And yeah, we're going to talk a bit more about that later in the programme. Coming on to Roots to Regeneration, this is a new transformational year-long programme that you're putting in place, which is running on Planton Farm, I believe, and possibly other places as well. And you're running with Caroline Grindrod.
Yep, so it's a hybrid programme, so a mixture of in-person, online live events, and online self-led learning. So for the nitty-gritty stuff like soil health, that'll be online self-led learning, so people can pick that up at their own pace. There's three kind of immersive in-person three-day events, one at 42 Acres in Somerset, one here at Planton Farm in April, and then another one at Galbraith Hall Farm in the autumn. And the idea is there's contact every fortnight, so whether that be in-person or online, it's very much a kind of coaching and knowledge programme. So there'll be lots of peer coaching and then inspirational guest experts. So we've got people like Joel Williams, Russ Carrington, Claire Whittle, Tim Parton, and a number of others.
So kind of Rob like Havard, yeah, Nicky Rob Yoxall.
Yes. Exactly, the whole list, yeah. Jonty Brunye, and so we've got we're kind of all bringing together and picking on everybody's particular piece of expertise to share that with the cohort. And I think that's a key part of it as well, is it starts in February, towards the end of February. Yes, there are some places still left, but we are booking up now. We start then, and the idea is it's part of what's great about it is a group of people going through a transition at the same time, share those learnings, support each other, and that's a big part of what we're trying to create as well.
And just before I hand over to Phil, who is it that's signing up for this? What sort of person is signing up for this course?
Regen curious people. So it's not people that have woken up one day and said, right, so I've been, I'm going to change. It's people that have explored already, maybe been to ORFC, Groundswell, etc., tried a couple of things, read a couple of books, read Gabe Brown's book, you know, like everyone does. But where maybe it's getting stuck is then actually going home and trying to implement that change, because it's kind of needs a bit of a system shift. It's not just about tweaking one or two individual bits. That can bring small results, but it doesn't usually kind of transform and get these great outcomes that people talk about when they go down a regen route. So it's those that are interested and have tried a few things. And we're also getting interest from people in the food industry. I mean, you can't go very far without some company or another claiming that they're now looking at regenerative agriculture, and therefore there's people within that that they really want to understand what that means and do a deep transition themselves, so that when they are starting to build programs for their supply chain, they really understand what is needed.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. And I just had one question, and some of the courses I've been on in the past, some of the farmers in the room say, this is a completely different and new way of thinking for me. Usually it's I read something in a book and it's very, very prescriptive, and this is going to take a while for me to get my head around. And one of the things I thought was really interesting, that it's not about just verbatim set of practices. It's trying to instill a bit of a mindset shift as well. And it's just a question of how you do that, and then how you measure it afterwards as well. How do you see people kind of going out and applying some of those things?
Yeah, well, it's because what we see is that everybody's own context is the most important thing to adopting new things. And that's part of what's been the problem. Why we've ended up some of the problems that we've got with maybe soil loss, flooding, etc., is because we've done this prescriptive, just do this, use this cultivation practice and these chemicals. And then what we've not taken into account is the unintended consequences of that. So this is a reversal. This is more of a coaching and mentoring program. There is the technical soil health, grazing planning, like actually it's not just theoretical, it is also got the practical in there, but it's within the frame of it being about helping people to find their own context and what they're trying to achieve, and then how do they bring about regeneration within their farm or wherever they are, wherever they're trying to do that. Yeah, so that is a because I think what we're seeing is with other programs that don't cover that is that they're not getting the lasting results. So that's what we see when we work with people one-to-one and we bring about this way of doing it, we get lasting results. So it's about how do we bring something that means it's not just one-to-one, you know, how do we bring that forward as a group coaching program.
And famously, Claire, you have gone through your own mindset shift, haven't you? There was a time when you thought this was just a whole load of a hippie nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. I emailed Alan Williams, who is one of the Gabe Brown's cohort with Understanding Ag, and told him in no uncertain terms that this would not work in the UK. And that's where it started for me. Exactly. We were farming organically. There's no better environmental farming than organic, so why is everybody saying all this stuff? I was definitely one of the it'll never work here, and then you know end up out wintering and grazing differently, and then suddenly you realize, but there's including getting a letter from our landlord at the time telling me that I was in breach of our tenancy for not keeping the land in good agricultural order because we were now letting the grass go long, and that was seen as bad practice. So yeah, I've definitely had my own unpicking to go through, and that is hopefully one of the things that is helpful for others, because I've definitely been there and been there recently in the last few years.
I just wanted to ask, is this going to be the only one, or is it the first of many? I'm hoping it's the latter.
Yeah. Yep, the first of many, we hope. Yeah, so the first one starts in February. That's going to be a year long, and we will learn a lot from that. But they're very much, we've built it to last. It's not been built as a kind of pilot. We've built this with the view that this is what's needed. I'm sure there'll be tweaks, but yeah, the plan will be to run again, and that's it. Basically that's it. Yeah, hopefully it's here to stay.
Can I ask you about mentoring? Because one of the things that always seems to me that's necessary, I mean, this is obviously, it's a year-long course for people who are already, as you say, regen curious, but there's still that point at which you go back on the farm, you need to do something, and you just kind of need an answer to a question. And is there the facility to be able to WhatsApp experts or WhatsApp each other in order to be able to sort of build up that knowledge and have real-time mentoring in place?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a number of different aspects of mentoring involved. So there's mentoring from Caroline and I, and that's the approach that we take when we're working with people. Secondly, we will introduce triad peer coaching, so set people up in groups. So there's kind of like peer mentoring that will be part of the program, and we'll train the cohort how to do that so that they can support each other in smaller groups. Of course, having an inevitable group-wide WhatsApp group for general support from on there, and then also the guest experts, and there'll be involvement from them and be able to get support from them in various ways throughout the time. So yes, it's that when you go, you see all the great stuff, but you go back home and you're faced with making a decision, and it's difficult to know which way to do. And often when we're faced with that, we revert back to what we know and feel more comfortable with. Then it's that point that will be there to be able to encourage a step forward.
Claire, where can people find out more?
Just Google Roots to Regeneration, and then it comes up with a page on the Roots to Nature website. Stick your email in there, and then you'll get all the information through the prospectus and opportunity to book and sign up.
Fantastic. Let's take a break. And we're back, and we're coming into the big conversation. And just before we do, I mean, thanks so much to Claire Hill for coming in and talking to us. That was just fascinating.
Yeah, it's brilliant, and really good to see that resource being rolled out. And Yeah, I'm sure it'll be very successful and really look forward to seeing what comes afterwards as well.
Now, we're going to talk about a couple of articles that appeared on the site, Cash Boost and New Incentives for Nature-Friendly Farming Welcomed. Now, this was essentially a news article built from a speech that Steve Barclay, the Secretary of State at DEFRA, gave to the Oxford Farming Conference. Now, he's talking about a 10% uplift in funding for nature-friendly farming. Is that really what's happening? And can you give us some incentives, some of those incentives that he's talking about?
I certainly can. Yeah, what we've seen is a pretty comprehensive offer that has been put on the table for 24-25. And the SFI, Countryside Stewardship, mid-tier, higher tier, and also landscape recovery. And everyone has been waiting for quite some time about around what's going to be next after last year's previous announcement. There's a lot of really, really good stuff in there. For one, there's been the average increase in payment rates across the board for a range of different options. So we've seen, as Claire mentioned before, we've seen some pretty significant uplifts in options such as species-rich grasslands. That's going to be very welcome for farmers who have that type of permanent pasture on their land and hadn't been getting the sufficient level of reward. And as Claire mentioned, there was the risk of kind of perverse consequences from that as well. It's not isolated to that. We've seen actions kind of increasing in payment rates in a number of different areas and across the board. And that's welcome to see. And I know a number of organisations, including ourselves, have been calling for payments that better reflect the value of the public goods that are being delivered, as opposed to the costs incurred of delivering those public goods, for example.
And lots on water, lots on agroforestry.
Yeah, we've seen a new action brought in on agroforestry. So there's a new standard attached to that. We've seen support for direct drilling and things like that, minimum tillage. We're also seeing, boosted actions for floodplain management and connecting things together. And some of the important elements of this, I think, are the new actions in place, the uplift in payment rates as well, but also some other areas which try to stitch together or combine actions to so that they individual actions equate for more than the sum of their parts, essentially. And that is really what is going to be key in delivering environmental improvement at scale. So DEFRA have communicated an ambition to bring in bolt-ons for high ambition actions, but also mechanisms to try and tie things together. Not just that, so we've also seen a commitment to deliver or improve the advisory offer. So that's going to be quite important in ensuring that farmers are delivering what's suitable for their land, are able to do that based on expert advice as well. That's quite key. And then one of the things that we were particularly pleased about at the Nature Friendly Farming Network was a commitment to double the amount of applications that are approved each year for countryside stewardship higher tier agreements, which is very, very, very welcome to see.
Absolutely. And just to go into some of the politics around this, and Steve Barclay set this up as being 10% more funding, a 10% funding uplift. Now, it's not actually new money, is it?
No, it's not new money. So the government have committed to maintaining the level of budgetary spend on agriculture of around 3.4 billion per year across the UK. It works out about 2.4 billion, I think. It's around that figure in an England context. And there's been no uplift in terms of the total money that is going to be given to agriculture as part of this. It's essentially the payment rates for different options are receiving an uplift. So it's not new money, but it will make hopefully a difference in terms of what farmers receive for delivering specific actions.
So for some things like the species-rich grassland, there's a great big uplift in the value of that, as opposed to other things where, you know, the payments perhaps remain quite similar.
Yes. So the 10% will be based on an average. And there may be some I need to look at it in a bit more detail after being away in Oxford that don't move at all, essentially.
Let me ask you this about the farming budget, sort of pre and post Brexit. I've always made the case that, you know, farming, in order to be able to deliver the change that's necessary, farmers have been directed by government, they've been directed by retailers. It's not just about farming changing, it's about having this partnership approach, and that farmers need to have more money in order to be able to create the change that's necessary in the very short timeframe that we have available. How does the budget compare pre and post Brexit?
It's the same level of funding that is going in terms of cash terms. So it's continued 3.4 billion per annum. But obviously with the impacts of inflation, the impacts of input rises, all that sort of stuff, in real terms, it's probably less than it was before. And yeah, we're one of many different organisations that are calling for an increase in that budget to deliver a lot of this stuff. And there's been various different bits of work which demonstrate that this isn't sufficient really in terms of buying those public goods that we need to kind of see.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, there was widespread applause really for this statement when it came out, this speech. You know, people were really pleased to hear what Steve Barclay had to say. But there was a tweet that came from Sue Pritchard, or an ex, I don't know what you call it these days. But anyway, a tweet from Sue Pritchard from the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission over the weekend. She said, "Now the dust is settling on the DEFRA SFI announcements, I'm struck once again that government has asked farmers to join a giant experiment in redesigning farm payments, in which farmers take all the risks, sometimes to an existential level." And of course, you know, for an awful lot of farmers, probably a third of farmers in England, you know, and I'm sure across the United Kingdom, were so dependent on the income support that was provided by the farm payments under the Common Agricultural Policy. So do you think that's a fair statement from Sue, that farmers are taking the risk, and as yet, government and retailers, the public, they're not really taking the risks? You know, there's a bit of a political risk if things go a bit belly up, but it's farmers in the fields, within their own businesses. It's their bums on the line.
That is a fair point. The alternative on this with these schemes, I suppose these help to ensure that there's a justification for continued funding in agriculture for the long term. Public money is under increasing pressure, across society, essentially. There is almost a need to justify that continuing expenditure, and I think this continues to be the best way to do that. The other element within this as well is this is helping to make agriculture less susceptible to certain risks further down the line as well, or that we're currently experiencing. And yeah, we don't have to look too far to see that there's been massive flooding impacts over the last couple of months. That's a risk in itself, which we can help adapt to and mitigate against through these payments. So I think if they are applied effectively, they help make agriculture less of a risky sector, hopefully, through doing this. But of course, we also need to see those other changes within different stakeholders that are involved in this system. And yeah, we want to see those being implemented. Again, this is a pretty transformational change. Where we've got to at this point in time, I think on the whole, is positive. It doesn't negate the need for action in other areas as well.
It's interesting. You were talking there about the, you know, the need to make the case to the public for continued funding. And I think this is, you know, a reasonable criticism of the National Farmers Union over the last few years, that they've always seemed to be fairly much on the back foot rather than the front foot. They've been, sort of firefighting to an extent, complaining about things that they're going to lose, trying to hold on to stuff where some other NGOs have been trying to lead the way. And there's been, you know, more of a conversation there. But it's always seemed to me that they've just, in terms of making that case to the public, things haven't really changed over the course of the last 80 years. The message has been food is good, British food is better. And actually, there is this case around public goods. There ought to be some great big campaign, you know, from across the farming sector and the environmental sector, that the public goods that are delivered by farmers, when they're done well, are so cost effective. You know, it's cheap as chips. The money that's being spent on this is so low. And there ought to be such a straightforward case for a decently substantial funding boost.
Yeah. And one of the things that we at the network have been working on with a number of others is trying to build this idea of a consensus of what could be achieved and what needs to be done to achieve that. And I think that is an attempt at really trying to articulate a compelling vision for the future of what farming can deliver for people and for society. And that's food. That's also an environment that is resilient to change, an environment that people want to engage with and get benefit from as well. And yeah, there's a job on to really sell it, because agriculture doesn't have this ongoing license to farm unless it has public support. And we spoke about it earlier on in the session, or today, around the difficulties that forestry is facing And there's no guarantee that we're going to continue to get that money coming in to do what we've always done. So there's a real PR move that's needed to ensure that, the funding goes to deliver the right things. Yeah,
and if farmers in the future are going to be producing not only food, but also biodiversity improvements, but also access, a whole range of things, then it's about making the case to the public that these are things, you know, on farmers' land, farming is a business. People don't just live on a bit of land and keep it pretty for the sake of it. It is a business, and there is a need to pay farmers to do this. Let me just come on to kind of one of my final questions around this, and we sort of touched on it, this idea of, you know, the dependency that an awful lot of farmers had on farm payments. Do you think that the sustainable farming incentive with these uplifts is going to fill that gap for those farmers whose businesses were really very dependent on public support?
For those that are most dependent or have been most dependent on public support to maintain their viability, these will definitely help. So those are those farm businesses generally that are in less productive landscapes, for example, and make very low returns from food production. So the uplift in payments for the likes of species-rich grassland and other semi-natural habitats will help, as will the ability to process more higher-tier schemes. That said, in many cases, the return from ELMS-type schemes is probably not going to be the same level as what was received under BPS. There are some farms that I speak to where it's actually going to be more, or it's going to be very similar, but I would say that that's not consistent across the board. But the other part within this is, it's not just the payment. So these schemes support a transition to more sustainable business management, less reliance on inputs, which bring with them costs. So there's that element as well. They can also make the business more resilient to the extremes of weather. They can support increased productivity through improvements in soil health, all sorts of things like that. So those need to be factored into this as well. And again, there's also a need for some of these farm businesses to look at potentially other alternative income streams and the private market as well to help bolster that. So it's not going to be a like for like replacement. It's part of a diverse kind of set of income streams, essentially. And there is a need to kind of look at things more differently. I don't think we're ever going to get to the sense where agriculture gets most of its funding from the public, and that's all it needs.
No, absolutely. And I don't think an awful lot of farmers would want to see that either. But it strikes me that there is a connection really between these two parts of the conversation, that that there's a need for comms, for communications outside of the various different bubbles. And if, you know, farmers, in order for their businesses to remain viable, need to pivot, need to diversify, need to perhaps look at more independent supply chains, then we need to become, we as a sort of alternative farming sector, if you like, need to become much better at being able to communicate those opportunities and facilitate those conversations with those farmers. At the same time, we need to be able to communicate with the public outside of the environmental NGO bubble, so that those people who live in urban areas, who have a tangential connection with the countryside at best, so that they understand that there's a case for public funding too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the other things which is key within all of this, which I think there could be more focus and more attention directed to, is the support that's needed for broader rural development and for other enabling type infrastructure, particularly in those landscapes which struggle to get a viable return from food production. So that's support for building skills, that's support for trying to create shorter supply chains within a landscape. So we're talking about national parks here, we're talking about uplands, places like that. We've seen moves from DEFRA to roll out a small abattoirs fund. That's very, very positive, but it needs to be part of this, I think, coherent rural development offer. And that is just as important as the payments for delivering environmental public goods.
Thanks so much, Phil. Let's move on to cross-compliance, because this is obviously connected. We've got a story on the website, Wildlife at Risk on Farms as Vital Hedge and River Rules Vanish. And this is, you know, the National Trust, the RSPB and the Wildlife Trust all concerned that, again, this is sort of going back to Brexit. We have this kind of succession of changes that are taking place as we gradually leave the rules of the European Union. So in the past, cross-compliance was what farmers had to do. It was basically rules in terms of the way they manage nature in order to get their farm payments. That was lost on January the 1st. There's concern that there's now a vacuum before new rules come into place. Often we don't even know when these new rules are going to come into place. What is the concern? And can you give us some examples, Phil?
Yeah, the concern is that we're losing quite an important mechanism in which there's universal conditions applied to all farm businesses to meet a minimum set of requirements which demonstrate a certain level of performance in terms of environment, in terms of animal health and welfare, all those sorts of things. With cross-compliance going, a lot of those are moving into national pieces of legislation or national regulation, but we lose a mechanism that kind of consolidates them all together and applies it to farm payments. The argument that is being made from the likes of the NGOs is that some of those requirements that were within cross-compliance, particularly some rules around hedgerows, and that's hedgerow management rules in relation to ploughing up to the base of the hedge. So under cross-compliance, you had to have a 2 metre buffer, some requirements in terms of the close season for cutting, and then also some requirements in relation to soil health and water quality, so maintaining soil coverage over the winter time, and also buffer strips around watercourses as well. So those will actually go. The rest of them will go into national legislation, but the difficulty is that those would be enforced by a range of different actors, whereas within cross-compliance, those were all under the remit of the RPA.
And just tell me about cross-compliance. I mean, it wasn't perfect, was it, by any means?
No, it definitely wasn't. It was an imperfect mechanism, which quite often failed to actually determine where non-compliance was taking place. Quite often focused on the things that were easier to monitor and enforce rather than the environmental impacts that were being delivered. But it had quite an important principle built within that to receive public funding, you had to deliver a certain level of standards. And the issue with this now is we don't have that. You, in theory, could be delivering an environmental improvement through ELMS, but you could also be delivering a negative environmental impact through other activities that you're undertaking in the farm. So there's a lack of coherence with it in that space. And then also we have a target from DEFRA that about 70% of farmers will be involved in a scheme. What happens to the other 30% if you don't have that kind of enforcement mechanism there? So there's concerns on that front as well.
And of course, there was, you know, quite poor enforcement, it has to be said, of non-compliance in the past as well. Often it seemed to rely on members of the public reporting things rather than anything else. And often, you know, that would be a slap wrist rather than necessarily a fine or a losing of farm payments. And so if you're having something in place that is trying to ensure that there is broadly good management of the countryside, then there is a degree to which whatever it is needs to have some teeth.
Oh yeah, definitely. And part of that is reliant on sufficient investment in the regulator or the regulators to enforce different pieces of legislation or different pieces of or different standards, essentially. And yeah, that's been wholly inadequate. And we've seen recently that DEFRA have made a commitment or have changed the rules around fines around water pollution, that you can have unlimited fines. And that's going to apply to agriculture as well. But if you're not actually monitoring or inspecting, then you're never going to really, that's going to be unlikely to be delivered. So
it sounds good in theory, but in practice, it relies on the government actually taking people to court. And there has very often seemed to be a very low level of interest in doing that in the past. So what's the solution? What's going to happen?
Yeah, so in relation to the hedgerow regulations that I mentioned briefly, there was a consultation in the summertime undertaken by DEFRA, which sought to seek views on how protection could be maintained, how that enforcement system could potentially look like. And there was responses to that. We haven't actually seen DEFRA's response, and we haven't heard what they're going to do. it would be relatively simple and straightforward to implement an SI, so a statutory instrument, that would bring through those gaps in regulation that cross-compliance, the loss of it, are creating, and move that into the hedgerows regulations. And those could be enforced by the RPA, potentially, for example. So there's a relatively simple solution.
That's the Rural Payments
yes.
Agency.
Yeah, there's a relatively simple solution in, I suppose, the toolbox to maintain the level of protection. But we need more considered and kind of concerted effort to build a better regulatory regime for farming. And that requires as much attention as we've had on the incentives and ELMs. And yeah, I think now that we've got a clear direction of where those are going, I don't think regulation should be seen as a dirty word and should be something that, yeah, I suppose government recognises that it does have an important role in meeting environmental targets, but also creating a fair and level playing field for farmers. That's pretty important within this.
So if we're talking about a vacuum, then listening to what you're saying there, there's a danger that that vacuum could actually last for quite a long time.
Yeah, there is a risk of that. And I would like to see a little bit more of communication on the importance of maintaining standards and delivering a certain level of performance, and a government that recognises that this is not a cost on business, but an investment, and can be quite useful in providing that baseline of minimum activity, which then helps to support, in a way, farmers delivering some of the more ambitious actions within ELM. So say, for example, we have regulation in relation to water quality or soil health. That's going to make you look at the likes of more diverse rotations, for example, the incorporation of kind of temporary lays, all that sort of stuff, to build soil health naturally, to build fertility. So regulation could have a complementary role in pushing the transition into some of the things that ELMS is paying for.
Look, we're coming towards the end of the programme. Let's just see if there's anything else on policy film.
Yes, we have covered in great detail the situation in England. The only thing I wanted to flag, and we spoke about it just before Christmas time, was that the consultation and the last consultation on the Welsh Sustainable Farming Scheme is currently live. So if you're a farmer in Wales, make sure to check it out. There's a number of different roadshows taking place across the country and online where you'll get a better understanding of what's being proposed and how you can get involved in that process and make your voice heard.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can Google Welsh SFS, which stands for Sustainable Farming Scheme. And if you go to 8.9, then you can put that into our own search and you'll come up with a page that gives you all of the various different roadshow events that are taking place between mid-January and mid-February, going from Carnarvon, Llangollen, Welshpool, Raglan, Bridgend, Machynlleth, and various other places as well. So I think that's bringing us pretty much to the end of the programme. So I just want to say thank you very much, Phil, and thank you to Claire Hill for taking the time out of her busy day to come and talk to us. So I've been Finlow Castain. Thanks very much for listening.
And I've been Phil Carson, and yeah, thank you for listening too. Happy New Year, everyone, as well.